Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:15 p.m. the Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 6th. We had a lot of shenanigans in Washington, D.C. today with the certification of the presidential election being disrupted by protests and an invasion by protesters into the Capitol building. That had a little bit of a knock-on effect to the value of shares at the end of the day, but I think the biggest thing that's happened today is the U.S. 10-year Treasury is back above 1% following the victory of the Democrats in Georgia. So now they have a clean sweep, or the other way of thinking about it is that they have got the blue wave. Well, with Democrat control of both the House and the Senate and the presidency, they can now have greater freedom to enact some of their more ambitious policies, most particularly to roll back some of the deregulation that the Trump administration had put through. But the bigger picture is that they'll be more willing to spend money. Now, of course, eventually they're going to have to start thinking about how to raise money, but in the meantime, they're more likely to spend. And that suggests that there could be an additional stimulus package this year. So obviously that is raising questions about the ability of the government to fund itself and where is the money going to come from. We are certainly now much more likely to move directly into the runway for debt financialization or debt monetization or modern monetary theory. The last time this was actively pursued in, I think, an outright fashion was in the late 60s, early 1970s, where the central bank simply printed the money that the government required. And that is looking like a decidedly much more popular outcome from the perspective of a lot of different countries around the world. What we're also starting to see is the specter of wealth taxes. The UK is certainly looking at those. The one-off wealth tax that Argentina announced last month is another obvious example. That's likely to be repeated in a number of other countries. What it helps to highlight is that governments are flat broke. They are running massive deficits. They have no real plan for how they're going to raise additional funds. Restive populations have very clearly stated in no uncertain terms they are not going to accept additional fiscal austerity, and they're not going to accept a decline in services either. Well, that pretty much means that governments are going to have to look elsewhere if they're going to raise taxes, which means that they're going to come up with new taxes. So we might be looking at carbon taxes, we could be looking at taxes on second homes, wealth taxes, business taxes, one-off payments, whether it is direct rent seeking from the government from well-capitalized companies, going after them for monopoly infringements and taking a tax in that regard, going after them in terms of business practices and levying massive fines. These are all potential ways of raising money and using the legal system against anyone who tries to protest. So obviously it's going to create a cottage industry in alternative ways of moving money around and looking for international locations which are friendly to that. But of course it's also going to raise significant amounts of money for governments. And once you move down that path and we're into a point where more than half of people no longer pay taxes and the onus for taxation falls on a successively narrower band of individuals, well, then there isn't really any barrier to how high those taxes can go. Of course, it also has very clear issues in terms of incentives. Now the big question is, with the 10-year yield back above 1%, this is a breakout. It's been ranging below that level for the last 2 months, and now we're seeing a break higher. If we look at this on a somewhat longer term basis, while we know that yields are extraordinarily low, there's been a clear uptrend since at least August. And as long as that remains the case, then this every basis point move in the near Treasury yield is going to have a knock-on effect for the ability of the US government to fund itself. That's quite obvious, but it also introduces a discount rate. We haven't had a discount rate, and I think that's one of the big points. When we then look at the spread between the 10-year yield and the yield on the S&P 500, well, it got down to almost a 200 basis point spread. It continues to contract. It's now coming back towards the lower side of the range that presented itself between 2012 and 2019. But the big picture, of course, is that the relative attraction of equities relative to bonds was particularly, forceful back at the beginning of 2020, less so today. When it goes back above zero, then you have a positive yield for bonds over equities. And that's when we start to then think about what competition means in terms of asset classes. So certainly we can also think about the fact that when this spread gets up to about 100 basis points, well, we had the taper tantrum in 2013, and we had a meaningful loss of confidence in 2018 as well. So then the big question is, what's going to happen in terms of yields? And what's going to happen in terms of the yield curve? Because certainly we're seeing that the banking sector in particular is doing well. And basically anything that's levered to global reflation and that benefits from somewhat higher interest rates is also doing well. The yield curve spread popped on the upside about 9 basis points over the last couple of days, reasserted its uptrend. Now it's a modest uptrend. It's been going up not in a particularly aggressive fashion over the course of the last 5 months, but it is rising and it is trending higher in a consistent manner. As long as that remains the case, then it's particularly beneficial for the banking sector, and the regional banks in particular have been resurgent, and they were up in a pretty dynamic manner in here today. The S&P 500 banks index was also positive, and that is also pushing on to a more convincing recovery. Then when we think about the FTSE 100, obviously it's not a banking index, but it is loaded with globally oriented companies, and the index is now back above, we need to put it in local currency terms, it's back above the 6,500 point level, and it is pushing back up towards 7,000. Well, 7,000 was the upper side of the range that persisted from about 1999 all the way through to approximately 2016. If it can sustain a move above 7,000, well, then we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. And the reality is that it's a likely scenario. When we look at the best performers on the FTSE in here today, they were all banks. And HSBC was up nearly 10%, so was Standard Chartered. So was Barclays up 8.25%. Then we look at the other big performers like CRH and Glencore in the material sector, or Royal Dutch Shell and Anglo American, BP and Rio Tinto, all up in excess of 5%. So certainly we're seeing that with the scope for continued spending by the US, coupled with spending by Europe and China, then investors are willing to look at the potential for global reflation. And then we think about the potential for inflation. Well, hard assets are some of the best ways of protecting ourselves against inflationary pressures. So that's another rationale for why anyone would want to look at banks and look at the mining sector. And of course, then we have the consumer sector as well, because with inflation, they get pricing power back. And this is, I think, part of the rotation that we're seeing right now. One thing that I find particularly interesting is that the NASDAQ 100 has stopped rising. It gapped lower off the lows, excuse me, gapped lower off the open in here today. It recouped most of the decline intraday and then gave it up again. But the big picture is that it has a very heavy weighting among the FANGs. And the FANG companies are those that have benefited most from the low interest rate environment. They've also been among the companies that have seen valuations expand aggressively over the course of the last year. And arguably, they're underperforming. We can see that there are a large number of materials and banking companies that have broken out to new recovery highs or all-time highs. Apple, on the other hand, is pulling back from its peak again. Amazon has also stopped rising. It's been going sideways now since July, despite the fact that we had the failed upside break to new highs in August and September. When we think about Microsoft, obviously it's in another different business, but again, it is a company that has benefited enormously from the interest rate environment such as we've had over the course of the last decade. And it was down in a pretty dynamic manner in here today. So we can definitely see that there's evidence of rotation going on, and the beneficiaries of rotation are the instruments that are most heavily offering a hedge against inflation and access to global growth. Well, small caps also benefit from global growth and also from the devaluation of currencies. The Russell 2000 has been resurgent, and it was up again in a dynamic manner in here today. But then we can also think about the continued strong performance that we've seen across the emerging markets sector. The CSI 300 in China was in strong territory in here today again, and continues to extend the breakout from its range. The Nifty index in India was a little softer. When we look at just a broad measure of the ASEAN area generally, then we can also see there's evidence of a clear recovery. And when we think about what are the areas that will do well, the one catalyst that emerging markets generally require in order to do well is a weak dollar, or the other way of thinking about it is strong domestic currencies. When the investors have the ability to pick up a carry in terms of the interest rate differential, the currency appreciation, and then the capital markets as well, then they flood into emerging markets. And the dollar, having rallied earlier today, was in negative territory again in here today by the close. I do think, though, that the dollar is oversold in the short term. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we might have some consolidation. But gold prices pulled back rather sharply today. And part of the reason for that was because of the backing up in yields. But the other point is that it was up in a reasonably dynamic manner over the last 2 weeks. It's right in the region of the peaks from early November. And we had, I guess, the other way, the clear way to think about it is we know what happened last time. There was a big downward dynamic. So we had a smaller downward dynamic in here today, and the price closed off the lows. I find it hard to rationalize why gold should be weaker in here today. One way of thinking about it is that there has been a bit of a correlation between gold and treasury yields. And as yields compressed, then gold prices had done well. As yields back up, then the gold price has been softer. That's certainly been the case since August. But the other way of thinking about this is, how long can yields be allowed to continue to rise? I still think that the big decision that the Fed needs to make is whether they're going to engage in clear yield curve control. If they try to adjust the yield on the long end of the curve by refusing to allow or to put a cap on the yield, then that is a green light to get into gold. Therefore, and I do think that the further that yields move above 1%, the more likely that that type of scenario is. Now, there was a report put out by Jeremy Grantham in here over the last few days, where he's expressing extraordinary bearishness and calling out bubbly activity. Of course, anyone who looks at the cyclically adjusted PE ratio has been doing exactly the same thing for years already. Most particularly, those same people are value investors who've seen their investments do particularly badly over the same period. So then we can take what is being said in the context of someone who has sat out much of the advance, but the points being made are just as also should be taken with seriousness, because there is a rationale behind them. The Federal Reserve in particular is a serial bubble blower, and they've also killed off more bull markets than any other factor combined. So the big question is, when will yields start to back up on a sustained basis, and when will interest rates eventually start to rise? We know that there are heavily levered sectors to interest rates. With the absence of a discount window, a discount rate, because interest rates have been so low, then companies that don't have earnings, that don't have profits, have done spectacularly well, and they have been among the best performers. They've also, and when we think about the ability of companies like Tesla to raise money, and the fact that it was up again for most of today, these are obvious examples of a rather strange phenomenon in the funding markets. But it's only sustainable as long as interest rates are zero. And that is a further example of how important it will be for the Fed to make a decision on whether they want to engage in yield curve control or not. Because if they don't engage in yield curve control, then they're pretty much going to have to massively increase the supply of money. Either way, that's likely to be inflationary. That's one of the primary reasons why anyone should be interested in gold. But right now also, there is a competing alternative asset, and that's Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was stronger again in here today, up an additional $2,400, and it has cleared the $3,500 level. I did highlight it was 2 days ago, that the low may have been in, that a reaction of about 20% is normal for this bull market that really started to kick off in August. So therefore, now we have some evidence and some, or at least another touchstone, that the low put in 3 days ago is now the most recent higher reaction low. A reaction of greater than 20% would be required to question the consistency of the advance. And so far, these ranges are one above another. So we can anticipate that the next area of potential resistance is around 40,000, and that it may be higher than that. In fact, if we think about where the resistance levels are, they have certainly been in the region of big round numbers. So it paused at 10,000, and it paused around 12,500. It paused at 20, it paused around 35, and now we're seeing that it is breaking higher again. It's quite likely, perhaps, that the next point of resistance may be at 50,000. But One thing that we're also starting to see is that forecasts for future potential are becoming progressively more aggressive. Yesterday we had people talking about $120,000. Then we had somebody from Guggenheim today saying that it might get to $400,000. I think the expectation that it could go that high is just a linear progression of the expectation that once it went through 1,000, it went to 20,000. So once it goes through 20,000, it might go up another 20 times. There is the potential that it can go further from here, because there's no evidence and there's to suggest that it won't. But one thing we do know is that if Bitcoin is going to get to that level, well, then we're going to have to see hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars flow into the market. And that's still a lot of money. And it's particularly a lot of money when interest rates are rising, when money is being printed out of thin air and it costs nothing, then the sky's the limit for where prices can go. And that has been one of the defining characteristics of the market all the way through. I think the least productive way of thinking about the market is how far it can go, and rather to monitor the consistency characteristics, because as long as it is consistent, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. When it stops being consistent, well, then that tells us that the imbalance between supply and demand has changed, and then we have to at least prepare ourselves for the potential that it will come back down and test the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And the 1,000-day moving average today is at about 8,000. So that is where the terminal value is likely to be following the next bear market. So obviously the price can go up a lot, but let's not ever forget that it can also come down a lot. When we think about what's happening with Ethereum, I remain of the belief that it is a high beta play on Bitcoin, and that so far that high beta has been a delayed reaction in much the same way that silver has had a delayed reaction to the bull market in gold. And Ethereum was up $100 again in here today. I think of that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.